Welcome to Bee's Table Talk, the new St. Paul Area Chamber of Commerce podcast. I'm your host, Bee Kyle, President and CEO. We are hosted by Ian Levitt in their amazing Studio Americana here in Minneapolis. We're excited to bring this programming to you. Throughout the year, we meet fascinating, accomplished people, always willing to talk with us, but not necessarily available to fit into our event schedule. So this podcast is our attempt to capture these conversations and share them with our membership and the broader employer community, and through a medium that fits our increasingly mobile lifestyles. We are delighted to have some interesting guests with us today. Jill Wiedemann-West, the CEO, and Russ Turner, the Training Institute Director for People Incorporated, an organization located in seven counties across Minnesota, whose administrative offices are in Mendota Heights. So I'm looking at both my guests, and thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for the invitation.
Thank you.
And as soon as I met Russ, I had to pause and ask him where he's from, because you all are going to hear him talk and wonder the same question. So Russ, can you tell us where you're from and how you got to Minnesota?
Oh, sure. Originally from Birmingham, England, and despite the lack of American in my voice, I've been here 18 years.
Marvelous.
And I have a family in St. Paul, and pretty ordinary story, really.
Well, we're glad to have you here.
Thank you.
We have a string of Brits. We just interviewed Chris Wright from the Minnesota United, and so you can just say whatever you like with your lovely tone, and we will be captivated.
Okay.
So I understand. First of all, I understand that you are celebrating your 50th anniversary this year. So congratulations.
Thank you.
Can you tell us, introduce us to People Incorporated, and where was your organization founded?
You know, the organization started out in a very humble way. 50 years ago, a pastor of a church in St. Paul named Harry Mahakian noticed men hanging around outside of his church. He suspected they were from the sort of rooming house next door. They didn't appear to have any place to go, so he invited them into the church for coffee. Upon inviting them into the church for coffee, he realized that many of them were veterans, and a number of them had some pretty significant challenges with chemical health issues and mental health issues, and it spawned him thinking that there was more that needed to be done, and People Incorporated was birthed. So we are a community-based entity, and we started out the way a lot of community-based entities do, which is really wanting to serve a population and trying to identify the gaps that they needed. And we grew accordingly on the passion of some leadership and the need of the community. And we're really, really proud to be here at 50 years and celebrating all of that extraordinary work.
Congratulations. How long have you been with the organization?
I've been with the organization 9 years. I was People Incorporated's first chief operating officer when I came in 2010. And moved into my role as CEO. It'll be 5 years on September 1st. So,
how does it feel? Speaking as a 2-year veteran now, who doesn't yet feel fluent in her job, how do you feel? Are you feeling fluent in the work you're doing?
I feel very fluent in the work that I'm doing, although it is a changing field. It is. There's a lot of moving parts because we are very affected by policy and politics and funding and workforce and just the general knowledge that's out there and the way people choose to interpret what does mental health mean to me, what does it mean in my community. So there's always lots of opportunity to keep my learning agile.
Well, what are the principles then that guide your work today?
You know, our principles are, I think continue to be pretty humble, although they've gotten more complex over the years. We really serve the individuals in our community that are among some of our most vulnerable. These are individuals who are in part or largely disabled by their illness. And when I say their illness, I'm not just talking about mental health. I'm talking about co-occurring mental health and a number of other things. A significant number of our community that we serve also struggle with chemical health issues, homelessness, trauma, and being medically fragile as well. These are folks that don't always have a lot of support. Sometimes they do. Many times they've been bounced through a lot of different services. They've experienced a lot of negative kinds of things as they've been trying to seek services and help. And they're individuals that just really have a lot of need, but have tremendous potential. We just have to serve them properly. So for us, we're very client-centered. We look at our clients and we make sure that whatever we're creating, whether it's a treatment plan or a goal, that it's being done in conjunction with that individual. We work very hard to help our clientele achieve the level of living that they want to achieve and to find the most independent way of carrying that out that meets their abilities. And we work very, very hard to learn from the population that we serve about what we're not doing well, what the community's not doing well, what the gaps in the system are. And we work hard to build into them.
That's really, really impactful. Thank you. You used the term, I've followed you over the years. I've been aware of People Incorporated and from a distance. And I've heard you use the phrase, mental health is health. Mm-hmm. Can you tell us what that means to you?
Well, it's interesting. You know, sometimes we develop, and this is true about a lot of things, not just mental health, we develop a sense of what we think something is based on the images that we are kind of given, whether it's through the media or whatever. And I think a lot of times folks, when you meet them, you'll say, you know, oh, I work in the mental health field. And they'll say, you know, I just don't know anybody with any mental health problems. That must be an interesting work. And I say, well, you know, we all have mental health. We do. We all have mental health. We struggle if our kids aren't happy. We move through things related to family of origin issues, whether it's the loss of a parent or a grandparent. We make job changes and have stress and maybe anxiety. I mean, but most of us manage it and we kind of move through it. Occasionally, we might need a little help by talking to somebody or whatever, but largely, most of us manage our mental health on a day-to-day basis, but we all have mental health. And if our image is always of the more spectacular things that happen under the rubric of mental health, I remind people that that's just not mental health. That's a circumstance, a thing that happened or something that we saw. But that if they think really hard, that they probably know somebody who has suffered with postpartum depression or really struggled with the death of a loved one, or had a lot of anxiety as they went from middle school to high school. And all of a sudden you start to see people kind of wake up and go, oh, yeah, I do have mental health. So it's an easy phrase, but not so easy to always capture, I think, with folks.
Well, and it's easier to separate and divide and see yourself or see those with mental illness as other, mm-hmm. right? Capital O, yeah. As in not me.
Right.
And so what you're really doing is connecting people in a way that has got to be impactful for those who are listening to.
Right. And there's a lot of things that are going on in the world around us at any given time. And even though a lot of the folks that we work with are pretty disabled by their illness, again, that's a continuum. And we all have it.
Well, let's talk about that. What are some services that you provide your clients with mental illness? And if that takes you into the Training Institute, Russ, please participate if you have any input there.
We do a number of different services. We have a whole system of care that really takes us from an outreach level where we have a central access team that can accept calls from folks and help them resource their needs, either inside our organization or in other areas. We work in outreach teams with homelessness, both in very coordinated programs in the cities that we're in, as well as just being present and helping to kind of move out into the community and find these individuals and make sure that they've got water and they're safe and their needs are met and try to move them towards leaving homelessness behind. We have clinic services where people can come in both for adults and for children, where we can work with folks and families around specific needs that they have therapeutically. And then also we have programs for kids that are embedded in schools. We call those school-linked programs. So we're helping individuals that are identified in the schools as needing more services get those services right there in the schools. All the way to, we have crisis facilities where individuals in acute crisis can come to an unlocked facility and have a professional help them work through what's going on for them. We have treatment programs for individuals. And we have housing solutions, customized living and adult foster care, and kind of everything in between. The continuum is intended to imagine that mental illness is a dynamic disease. And I might be tracking just beautifully, and then something might happen, and I might need to step back to a different level of the continuum, and then I can kind of regroup and move forward. But our goal is to have a continuum that tries to meet the individual wherever they're at.
Great. And then what specifically then is your training institute, Russ?
So when you listen to Jill talk about the people that we work with, people we serve, I mean, thinking about those clients, if you switch your attention now and think about the practitioners, the social workers, the workers, and those mental health professionals, in order to achieve that person-centered, client-centered, meet them where they're at line of thinking, they need training. It's not as easy as it sounds. It's difficult to align with folks who are not doing well. And so the Training Institute is, it's a relatively new venture, but it's not a new idea. I've been working at People Incorporated longer than Jill, and I've been there since 2006, actually, building a training department and developing courses around those principles of connection and empathy and communication skills and working with someone in a crisis and that kind of thing. And so what we noticed over the years, and particularly in the last five or six, was a growing interest from the community in the materials that we're teaching to our staff. And we had we used to do most of our training in a big ballroom at one of our beautiful locations on Park Avenue in Minneapolis. And we had plenty of room in there. And so we were filling empty seats, essentially, with people from other similar agencies. And we started to build up a kind of equity in the human services community. And people were starting to see us as a place where they could get good training, essentially. And so we sort of decided maybe we should build out of that and create a professional institute. So now we have a location in Eagan. It's a couple miles up the road from the admin office. And in that, well, we have two classrooms there. I have two trainers. I have a coordinator. So we have a team of four of us delivering a curriculum that's pretty robust. We have nine series of trainings, somewhere in the region of 40 classes. Around trauma and skills and clinical issues related to mental health, things like that. So we've built this kind of community resource that's hopefully doing a couple of things for us. One is helping us connect with lots and lots of different types of people, agencies, organizations, corporations, radio stations, media, to talk about mental health, because we want that's the starting point. You know, if you're not talking about it, then nothing much is happening. So we're destigmatizing by talking about mental health openly, freely, without judgment, shame, guilt, etc. And at the same time, we're providing professionals with their accredited classes for their board certification, for their licenses, and just working in that kind of arena.
So who could be a person sitting in one of your classes? Outside of the certification process for among professionals, who else might want to join you?
Well, so if you look at the rosters of our classes, I was literally telling Jill this the other day, that the rosters are starting to look pretty interesting because usually if you've got 30 people in the class, half of them will be our staff. And the others will come in from similar agencies, or maybe they work for Ramsey County and Oka County, that kind of thing, some of our partners. More and more, though, people are coming in from different organizations. People are coming in from places that you wouldn't normally associate with mental health. We had employees of a grocery store in our class a couple of weeks ago. people from credit unions, people from law enforcement, from corrections. It's really becoming very diverse in the sense of different types of jobs, which, by the way, makes learning more effective, more interesting, more perspectives. So that list of where people are coming from is just growing and growing.
And people are wanting to learn and develop competencies in serving that community, because to your point earlier about mental health is health, we all run into mental health challenges with our staff, with our families, with ourselves, and you're giving people skills.
I have a great example.
Please.
I'm currently working with the Hennepin County Library System, which has 40-something libraries, a huge system. And if you think about a library, it's a community space. People are coming in from wherever they're, you know, normally hanging out. And so there's a need there for their staff to be better informed about trauma, about mental health, about chemical health, about addiction, about behaviors, et cetera. And so that's the kind of client that the Training Institute is working with a lot now, is organizations whose primary mission is something a little different to, you know, mental health, but nevertheless, they're working in and around it all the time. So we train their practitioners on crisis de-escalation, trauma-informed care, motivational interviewing, and compassion fatigue, which is so interesting because organizations like Hennepin County Library and many others I could bore you with, I've got a whole list here, is they're realizing that their staff are being asked to do a lot. You know, they're being asked to do their primary role, but they're also being asked to work with, like you were saying, these people that are coming in. And what we're teaching is how to connect and how to see it differently and how to kind of make that work, because they're just people with mental health, just like everybody else.
Mm. I really like that, connect rather than disconnect. I mean, that requires us to treat one another as included as opposed to excluded. And so you mentioned a couple of times, both of you, this idea of partnering with other organizations. So I imagine there's a continuum of care. And who are some other, what are some of the other organizations with whom you work to serve your client base?
We are very gregarious. We go out and we work to connect with everybody. One of the things that's really true is the individuals that we serve, because our systems largely are cohorted by funding kinds of issues, it doesn't take long to realize that whether you're feeling sad about a person that you see in the library every day during the coldest winter months who you think might be homeless and doesn't seem to be doing very well, or whether you're an ED technician or nurse or doc who sees the same person coming in every day, or you're a police officer recognizing somebody who's very dysregulated or perhaps not getting their needs met that you meet in that way. We're all actually seeing our most vulnerable, but somehow we're just starting to realize that we're all working with the same group, with the same, you know, that has these deep needs. So, you know, for us, I mean, our counties are really big partners for us. They do a lot of really navigating for the social services work. We work with a lot of our other partners in the metro area, other agencies that do the same thing that we do, maybe do some different things that we do, and really work with them as well. We are working with the St. Paul Police and have worked actually in other capacities through training and whatnot with many police departments who are really starting to recognize that they need to understand more about this community that they're coming into contact with so much and how to best work with them. So our partners are numerous. Right now we work very closely with the mayor's office in St. Paul because they have a huge initiative related to the homeless population in St. Paul. We work with the hospitals very closely. We are an equal opportunity friend, for sure.
So give us a little bit more detail on how you partner with the police force. Can you give us a scenario?
We have partnered with police forces in a number of ways. I can let Russ talk a little bit about some of the training. We get asked to do a lot of training, things like motivational interviewing, nonviolent intervention, things that help the police officers to really understand how to work with somebody who's in a dysregulated state due to mental health. In St. Paul, they put together a really, I think, creative and pretty current program that has them creating what they call their community outreach unit, which started out with just helping mental health related cases. So when someone calls, 911 and says something's going on here in my house, or someone needs to come and help me, this is how I'm feeling. When the police go out, they do the best that they can, but up to a certain point, they're only able to basically just determine, do I need to transport you to the hospital, or what do I need to do? And then they found a lot of those folks were people that called frequently. So they created this unit, which I thought was just really quite brilliant, where they identify a select group of police officers that do this community work, and got them really trained up in kind of looking at all of the different things that we train in. And then they actually went out to the community, us being part of that community, and said, would you be willing to give us a social worker to ride along with our team that could help, once we know that the environment is safe and secure, these individuals to find their, finally get their needs met and get into the system in some way? We were thrilled to do that. And we put in a social worker named Amber with the St. Paul Police now almost 2 years ago. And what happens is that she works with the team. She offices right there with the community outreach team. And when they go out on calls, she goes with them and works to actively engage the client, de-escalate the crisis, and find really strong, sustainable solutions for that client to get the services that they need so that they don't have to call 911 to deal with whatever they're dealing with.
That's fabulous.
It is. It's wonderful.
So how does your organization get funded so you can have social workers and the training program and all of the programs that you offer?
Well, I mean, we're largely funded by a fee-for-service, but it's for the mostly the Medicaid population, the folks that are on medical assistance. However, we also fundraise, and we fundraise for these new ideas, these new ways of kind of building into the community in a bigger way. We were really grateful to get some very core foundational funding to actually help us sort of move the Institute into the next direction. We've had very grateful donors who said, I love what you guys are doing with the St. Paul Police. We want to try to support that. We write grants for creative solutions, but largely we're an organization that bases our revenues on fee-for-service. That said, we are very aware of making sure that we have access for folks, and that does mean that we have a very active and vibrant charity care program, and we do a lot of services every year that we don't get paid for, but we feel are mission critical. So we try to balance it the best we can, some years better than others.
You use what's called an integrated care approach mm-hmm. to mental health. Can you address that in the context of what's on my mind as I'm listening to you is the challenge of it's sometimes the person who needs help is the one who says, I don't need it, mm-hmm. right? There's that challenge of resistance to help or resistance to acknowledging that I need help. Can you talk a little bit? Maybe those two aren't connected ideas, but can you address that for me?
Well, they are connected. I mean, the integrated approach is really just looking at that whole person, recognizing that we're all complex humans, and someone who lives with mental health issues or chemical health issues is even more complex, right? And so looking at that individual and saying you are your diagnosis is not enough. And we have to look at what's their support system, what's their current housing situation, do they have medical issues that might be playing a role in how fragile they are or their ability to manage their mental illness. Are they using chemicals? Do they have a history of trauma? All of these things which create that complexity that, we really have to be teaching because it's always moving. That's the integrated model. I don't look at someone with just their and just look at their mental health. I look at them when they come to us in a very whole person way, trying to solve for whatever is going on for them. Many times, you're right, folks with mental health issues, particularly more intractable mental health issues, will not see that they need help. But sometimes the way that you can find into helping them get access is by looking at things like their housing needs.
Practical needs.
Or they're dealing with an infection that they have on their foot or whatever it might be. And then slowly build that trust. For a lot of our clients, trust is a big piece. And, you know, sometimes it takes time. It's a little bit of a long game in that sometimes you have to build that trust. So maybe you don't want to talk about your mental illness or you think I'm not right and that you don't have any mental health issues. But, you know, we talk about maybe trying to find you some housing or we try to get you some access to something else you need or some health care to fix a problem that you're having physically. As we're building that trust, it does give us the natural ability to kind of move in that direction and try to build a relationship that where they might at some point say, well, maybe I will talk to the psychiatrist.
So you had a thought, Russ?
Oh, you know, I wanted to mention that if you're a person that has to go and see, you know, a person over, you know, organization over here for mental health, and you have to go somewhere else for chemical health, and you have to go somewhere else to talk to them about diabetes, and somewhere else to go, you know, that's just, clients tell us that's just demoralizing. And if you're working with people whose mental health is fragile, you don't want to build a system that's demoralizing. So it's an attempt at an answer to that, and it's becoming known as behavioral health. It's a more catch-all term. But can I mention another thing? Because you're talking about practical solution with maybe housing. The Training Institute has a wonderful partnership developing right now with DHS, Department of Human Services, and Minnesota Housing to provide de-escalation training, crisis training, if you like, and a bit of trauma training in there so that people can better understand, you know, what's happened to the people that are struggling so much. Over the next 3 years for landlords and property managers. So there again, that, you know, back to your other question of like, well, who's in that classroom now? Landlords and property managers are very interested in better communication strategies and a deeper understanding of tenants and the other people that end up in the housing, you know, and how to work effectively with them. So there's just another good example there. It's all sort of starting to get all integrated together. And it's all coming along pretty fast now. You know, if I think back 10 years, so that I was just thinking about it, like the kinds of people that have been were in the class 10 years ago were the social workers and the mental health practitioners, and they're still there and they're pretty awesome. But there's all this new influx of different types of individuals and workers and professionals that are interested in kind of this question of like, well, what's going on, like with what's happened here, and when you start to get a picture of that, then you can understand how the connecting skills work, and that's what we build off.
Well, so let's talk a little bit about how does someone connect with you. Let's make the assumption that a person is desirous of reaching out to your organization. How does one engage? And do you have perhaps a story to share with us about a client you've worked with and perhaps the process he or she went through?
Well, people can engage with us in a lot of different ways. We do have a central access number. That central access number, when folks call into that, they can get connected up with services inside our organization. Or if we're not the right organization to help them, we will refer them to someone else. But it does give them the ability to talk to a live voice, which is really, really important to not get. These folks get caught in a lot of voicemail cues and whatnot. Yep. And yep. So that's really, really important.
And that number is?
651-774-0011.
Great. 651-774-0011. And we'll add that at the end of the podcast.
That would
as
be
well.
Great. So that's certainly one way that folks can. A lot of the referrals also can come from other agencies, just like we refer to other agencies, and they can find their way in that way. We do walk-in therapy at two of our sites. So at our clinic in Coon Rapids and our clinic in Minneapolis, every day folks can come in if they want to just see somebody and connect up. So that's another way that they can access us. We also have a number of activities that we do in the community. One of the really extraordinary activities that we've been doing for a number of years is something called Artability. And Artability is a series of workshops that we offer in the community, not just to our clients, but to anyone who self-identifies as struggling with mental health. And we don't ask any more questions than that, but we do watercolor and oils and poetry and sculpture and all kinds of different things. And we do hundreds of these workshops all over the metro and during our 50th year all over the state, which also gives people an opportunity to come in and find a different way to manage the dialogue that they're having about who they are and where they're at that day through art and other things, but also it connects them directly to us and they build a relationship. And if they feel like they need some other services, it's a great opportunity. Those workshops are readily available and on our website, anyone can sign up.
Great. Thank you for that. So a question at, from me as I work in downtown St. Paul, I'm walking about the city, and I'm imagining this is a question a lot of people have, which is, how do I engage? What's my job? I see someone in crisis, clearly homeless on the street, or someone looks like they're struggling visibly with a mental health challenge, and we don't feel prepared or knowledgeable about what to do. What's my job here? Can you help me talk through what's my job in a regular day engaging with people around me in St. Paul or any other city? How do I do that in the most thoughtful way?
Well, I'm sure Russ has some ideas here that will probably be really helpful as in this as well. But, you know, everybody's different in terms of their comfort level with a kind of running into somebody who's talking to themselves, walking down the street. And you have to go with what you feel comfortable in managing. There's a lot of things that you can do. You can have a lot of times we pack these bags, for instance, that have like some basic needs kinds of elements. And we encourage people when they pull up to the, you know, to have a handful of those bags sitting in the back. So when they pull up and someone's flying the sign, help me, please, anything helps, that you can open your window and not disengage and look the other way, but hand them a bag. And in that bag might be a bottle of water, some information, maybe a granola bar, pair of socks, dry socks or whatever, mittens if it's winter. So there's little things like that that you see happening kind of all throughout the community around that. In someone who's dysregulated on the street, if you're not comfortable with that, then you should follow your gut and you should be like, you know, I just need to kind of move forward. But I think the fear of engagement is one that a lot of people do have. And honestly, there's nothing wrong with saying good morning. There's nothing wrong with acknowledging. These are our members of our community who are just in a really not great space right now. But also, I think it's really important for us to acknowledge that in some cases it does feel uncomfortable coming from where I'm at with it. I think the most important and most valuable thing that you can do is just be aware that this is the fabric of our community, and whether they're big problems or they're little problems or they're just uncomfortable feelings, this is our fabric and it's kind of all up to us to figure it out.
So assuming then, take another perspective on that, which is I'm uncomfortable engaging with someone I don't know, no matter who that person is, but I'm very interested in supporting your work. How would I do that?
You know, you can become a volunteer. You can, become a donor. You can take a training from Russ and just know a little bit better how to manage to feel more comfortable. Even if you may not ever change your behavior as you're walking down the street and come across that dysregulated individual that's kind of pacing, you are going to, I mean, one of the most beautiful things about training is that, as Russ said, it opens us up to a different dialogue. And even if you never really get to that place where I'm comfortable saying, sir, are you okay? because many of us wouldn't, right? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It gives you confidence to understand your limits. Mm-hmm. It gives you confidence to understand how to maybe work with those folks. And it just makes you a little bit more aware of where you fit in that space. And there is nothing wrong with that. Awareness is a really big deal.
So then going back to helping the community at large support our community surrounding us, we all have mental health challenges. Some of them are more immediate and in crisis than others, right? So I'm looking at you, Russ, and asking the question about you're going back to your training institute. Someone wants to learn how to, I've got a person who, a family member or a neighbor or a friend who's clearly in crisis, who clearly doesn't think he or she is. What do you do? How could we turn to your organization to get some help to learn how to manage that?
Sure, I've got a class on that.
Do you? Tell us about that.
So one of the series, I mentioned we had 9 series. One of them is a community track, and it's completely free. It's part of our idea of giving back into the community. And it's a free track. And just what you mentioned, the class, the most appropriate class is Mental Health First Aid, which is a class that's actually a worldwide class. It's developed in Australia originally. The National Council of Behavioral Health in the United States have grabbed that material and that idea and promoted it. And one of my trainers is a certified trainer in that course for adults, and my other trainer is a certified trainer in that course for youth. So that would be the best starting point. Those are both great classes. They're free, and I should mention, even if you looked at our website and found classes that weren't offered for free on the community track and you thought maybe you couldn't afford them, please email us and we'll almost certainly give you a scholarship, because we want to fill those seats and get people engaged with learning. And I should say also, the learning isn't easy. Like, we don't create classes that are simple, that you just sit back and they're a little challenging. And that's when learning happens, when there's a little bit of dissonance there. We have to think very carefully, like, this person just said this to me. How do I respond? What's an empathic connection that's skillful, that's intuitive, that's, you know, so we'll push you. But that would be the starting point, would be an adult or youth mental health first aid class.
Appreciate that. Thank you.
Sure.
So let's zoom out for just a moment, and from the individual to the community at large, what trends are you seeing? As soon as you mentioned youth, Russ, I was thinking about, you know, extemporaneously, I've heard about trends, youth homelessness is increasing. Mm-hmm. And can you talk a little bit about the trends you are seeing in mental health and homelessness in the community?
Well, I think, you know, some of that is, you know, out there at a much more nationwide level, and the state of Minnesota, we're seeing very, very high levels of suicide quite alarming levels of increase in suicide amongst our youth, young adults. so I think that's, you know, certainly a significant trend I think we really need to really understand. You know, we've had a couple of very high-profile suicides in the last year, and people pay attention to that. But the numbers are staggering, and we really do need to understand how do we do a better job of managing sort of community mental health so that we're able to really see those numbers come down. That's certainly one area. The other area that we see is the complexity, the individuals that are coming in with lots and lots of things that need to be addressed besides mental health or besides that one other thing. And I suspect that if I was sitting here right now with an emergency room doctor or any one of a number of different professionals, they would tell you the same thing. They're out there a little bit longer without getting their needs met. By the time we're getting them into the system and finding ways to help them, there's just a lot that they need to be addressing. So complexity is definitely, I think, going up. Housing is a huge issue. No matter what I do to try to help you feel more stable and more competent in managing your life. If you're going to go and live in under a bridge, or even try to get a shelter bed on a nightly basis, without any real safe and secure way to manage your mental health or whatever other issues you have, it's not going to last. And so we do see a lot of individuals who are continually rotating through the system because there's one piece still missing. And I think housing is a really significant piece we need to pay really close attention to. And I think that that's probably equally true for adults and youth. So, I mean, those are some trends that we're really seeing. I think the other thing is there's always that pressure politically around funding sort of those individuals on public assisted programming and whatnot. And we've got to figure out how to make a more sustainable system. So every time there's a crisis at the state or federal level, and we're looking to cut money out of a budget, that we're not cutting it out of the place that we're serving our most vulnerable and needy. Mm. I understand that that's the way that it works, but I think we really need very real reform to try to figure out how do we make these systems truly sustainable and make them accountable to the value and the impact that they're supposed to be having to the community. I think that that's fair. But I think it's a really pretty significant issue.
Well, I'm so grateful for that input. Thank you. One final question for you, which has to do back to us and our role supporting your organization, supporting the community at large, supporting the folks around us who may be struggling with mental health. Give us one or two specific recommendations. We should know who you are, peopleincorporated.org. We should know your phone number, your central access line, 651-774-0011. And then if there's a general question, someone's either in crisis or someone is observing someone in crisis, is there a step one is the phone number, step two, anything else specific?
I think the thing to do there is is to see that it's a person. Mm. And to start with that, because if you can keep this sort of armor up that, well, that's those people are over there and I'm here and there's a sort of separation. Mm. If you can get rid of that and take that and be a little bit vulnerable and try and connect with them, use their name and be really thoughtful about the words and the language that you use. Even if you're just describing that incident or something you saw today to your friend or family member later on, just think about the words you're using to describe what you've seen or what you've heard, and use a kind language.
Give us an example of that, because I think that people don't even know how to speak about this. So give us an example of that, because that's great.
So it's not a crazy person.
Right.
It would be a perfect example. It's a person who was struggling with something. Mm-hmm. It looked like maybe something psychiatric, and, you know. And if you just talk about it like that, you've just immediately put the person first. Mm. And so when Jill talks about being client-centered and person first, we have to train people on how to speak about it. But if you thought that if that person that you saw was someone you knew and loved, you would speak about it in a certain way. Mm-hmm. And if you can do that to someone you don't know, then you're doing them a massive service because what you're doing is destigmatizing it. Mm. And we got to start there, because if we can't talk about it in a way that's normal and validating and, you know, not so them and us, then you really haven't got a starting point. So I would start with that. A person who was, you know, I saw a man and it looked like he was hearing voices, you know, and he was struggling with that. And that's very different to, well, there was this crazy schizophrenic guy and he was freaking out. Mm-hmm. You know, so change that first and see that person, because that person is almost certainly someone's brother, someone's dad. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So if you can get to that and start from there, that'll be a pretty good start.
If you go back to that comment that I had made earlier, that example we were talking about, walking down the street and seeing somebody pacing down the street that was talking to themselves, and you may have a lot of comfort to say good morning, or you may feel really uncomfortable about the whole thing, and owning where you're at. Mm-hmm. But to Russ's point, you've probably also seen an individual who walks by them and says, "Get away from me," or mm-hmm. or something like that. For an individual that's in that space, that's just such a horrible, horrible way, because they feel like that every day. Like right. they feel like nobody wants to engage. It's almost better just to be quiet. But when you talk about it later, instead of saying, "Oh my gosh, there was this guy, I was walking to the train and it was so scary and he was talking to himself and pacing and he just had this look in his eyes," and instead of doing that, really talking about, "Gosh, there's just this really vulnerable man and I could tell he was really struggling and I felt really uncomfortable and I didn't feel good about it, but I have to own that I didn't really know what to say. But boy, it's got to be really hard to be living that kind of a life. And gosh, I hope they get the help that they need." And, you know, really just saying something like that versus, "Oh my gosh, I was so scared." Mm-hmm. It can be such a huge change in terms of the way that not only that person hears you, but how they might interpret a similar circumstance a week or a month down the road.
Mm-hmm. Appreciate that more than you know. And thank you for joining us today.
Thank you.
So again, thanks to Jill Wiedemann-West, CEO, and Russ Turn, the Training Institute Director for People Incorporated, headquartered, administrative offices anyway, in Mendota Heights. Again, thanks for coming, you both.
Pleasure.
Thank you.
So we look forward to having you at our next Bees Table Talk. And for now, have a great afternoon. Dun, da, doo, dun.